Welcome to the IBM DB2 Data Sharing Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Diane McCollum. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everybody, to Why DB2 for ZOS Data Sharing Should Be in Your Life. My name is Diane McCollum, and I am the Worldwide Sales Leader for IBM's DB2 for Z and DB2 and IMS tools. I will be your host today. Our speaker today is Mark Rader, an IBM Consulting IT Specialist with the Dallas Systems Center, supporting DB2 for ZOS. Now I'd like to turn it over to Mark. Mark?
Thank you, Diane. And welcome, everyone, to today's call. Hopefully you've had a chance to download or otherwise view the presentation materials. I'm starting on page one, and because we have a lot of material to cover, I will get going. The way this works, and it's being recorded, we'll hold all questions to the end, and at the end I've saved some time so that any questions you come up with during the course of the presentation, you may ask them. So I'm proceeding on to page two, which is the basic disclaimer and trademark screen, and I'll proceed right on to page the third slide, which is actually number two, for objectives. And my objectives today are to introduce the DB2 data sharing concepts, to describe to you how DB2 data sharing and the parallel SysPlex environment in which it operates provides the on-demand infrastructure for increased availability, non-disruptive scalability, and dynamic workload balancing. Along the way and at the end, I'm going to try to answer some common questions, and hopefully that will address a lot of them that are out there in the audience. And then at the very end, we've got a list of additional sources of information in case you want to do additional research on data sharing. Page three is our agenda, so I'm going to start by describing what DB2 data sharing is and why customers implement it, and then I'll start working on the DB2 data sharing concepts, including coupling facilities and how DB2 uses them, some discussion of performance and availability as it relates to DB2 data sharing, and then get a little more into workload balancing and how that works. And then again, we'll wrap up with the frequently asked questions, and then we'll open up for your questions. So what is DB2 data sharing? Well, there are two definitions that I like. The one is that DB2 data sharing is what allows applications that are running on more than one DB2 subsystem to read and write to the same set of data concurrently. The other definition I like is that DB2 data sharing allows customers to provide the highest level of scalability, performance, and continuous availability to their enterprise applications that use DB2. So either one of those works for me, and our little diagram you see here shows how we have multiple DB2s that are accessing a same pooled set of data, and they're using coupling facilities to be able to do this efficiently. Now, why would it be good for you to go to data sharing? Well, let me explain what other customers have found going to data sharing, and maybe some of these will match your situation. One of the early drivers for data sharing was capacity. When a workload that used DB2 would get too big for one system, it would be necessary to bring in additional compute power, and we had to bring in an additional machine to do that. And data sharing would allow that to happen most easily, at least from the application point of view. Now, recently, IBM's producing bigger and faster mainframes, and so the capacity problem is less of a problem for emerging data sharing customers. So what's driving people today to go to data sharing typically is the second one, which is the higher availability requirements. As applications need to be more and more close to 7 days, 24 hours per day, and 365 days a year, being able to protect against planned and unplanned outages is something that DB2 data sharing is very strong at, and so customers are finding that very useful. A number of customers like data sharing for the accommodation of growth. That is, they're either in an industry that's growing dramatically, or they're in the mode where they're acquiring or merging with other companies, and it's very easy to grow their environment if they have DB2 data sharing. And, of course, most customers find a lot of benefit from dynamic workload balancing. The ability to take advantage of all the processing capacity on the floor, even when the workload, the characteristics of the workload shift over the course of the day, or when you have unpredictable workload spikes. Now, what makes all this make sense is that the application investment that your company has is protected. So the SQL interface hasn't changed. The SQL statements you used before still work and still do the same thing that they did before. In addition, the applications you're running today do not have to know that they are suddenly in a data sharing environment. They don't have to know that they're on node 1 or node 2 or node 3 in a data sharing environment. And I didn't have anywhere else to put this, so I'm putting it right here. Right now, the largest data sharing environment that we know about is a 17-way data sharing group. Moving on to slide 6, I want to briefly describe alternative parallel database architectures. Because depending on where you are and how much familiarity you have with data sharing, you may see a lot of this discussed, and oftentimes the words data sharing will be used in this context, and I want to be clear on the kind of data sharing I'm talking about today. So at the top of this chart, you will see something called shared nothing. In this case, you have multiple nodes, and each node has its own set of data. This means that we've taken the set of user tables and we've broken them into pieces so that each node only gets one piece of the table. A simple way to think of this would be a customer address book, and each node would have one or more letters in out of the address book. And this has some advantages and some disadvantages. Partitioning the database is fundamental to this approach. One of the things that means is that node 1 cannot access directly the data that's being supported by node 2. So access across the nodes is going to require a lot of communication between the nodes. If you start doing a lot of updating or start loading data that isn't balanced across the partition, you then run into other difficulties. And if you decide you need more capacity, you know, and by adding nodes, the only way to get those additional nodes to be useful is to split the data into different partitions for those nodes. So it's a very complex way to handle dynamic growth or change in your data. The second architecture in the middle is called shared disk. Now we have multiple nodes, and they're going after a common set of disk. Now this has some immediate advantages over the first one. There's strong failover, right? If you have a failure node 1, you can still access the data from nodes 2 through N. You can do dynamic load balancing. But there are some issues with concurrency and coherency control. That is, if the different nodes are accessing the same data, or if they each have a copy of data, if they've buffered some of the data and one of the nodes changes that data, they have to send a lot of messages back and forth to be able to manage that. And that messaging overhead severely limits the scalability. So the bottom picture is the one that DB2 does in a parallel sysplex environment, and we're calling that shared data. Now, it is actually an adaptation of shared disk. What we've done is put the coupling technology on top of the picture, and this is functioned as high-speed shared memory, and it really addresses that messaging overhead. So each of the nodes can get at all the data, and we can do failover and workload balancing as well as or better than the shared disk implementation. And we've got flexible growth. But the big advantage now is that instead of the nodes messaging back and forth between each other, most of the messaging goes to the coupling facility, the coupling technology, which is accessed at very high speeds and therefore allows minimal messaging between nodes and enhanced scalability. So that bottom picture is the one we're going to be working with today. I'm moving on to page 7. DB2 data sharing runs in a parallel sysplex environment, and it makes sense for us to describe what makes up a parallel sysplex. So as we go forward, you'll have this in your mind. some of the characteristics of a parallel sysplex are scalable capacity. As you see, we've got multiple different mainframes shown in this picture, and it's very easy to add a mainframe if we need to increase our compute capacity. The flexible configuration is represented by the different shapes of the boxes. You can have multiple levels of mainframe technology, multiple sizes, each participating in a parallel sysplex. Workload balancing here is the ability to run work, whether it's DB2 work or other work in your enterprise, on different ones of these machines, depending on which one has the most capacity at that point in time, or which one I've taken down to add more compute power to. So we can achieve very close to 7x24 availability if we manage this correctly. Certainly the parallel sysplex provides 7x24, and then applications can take advantage of that if we do things right. The parallel sysplex can be managed as a single system image, which is makes it a lot easier on operations. Now, what makes up a parallel sysplex? I've listed the primary components here. If we're actually doing a parallel sysplex implementation, there'd be a much longer list. But the key ones that we need to think about for today are parallel sysplex timers, which give each image in the plex an agreed-upon view of time of day so that messages and updates can be synchronized. The coupling facilities. Now, when I describe a coupling facility, I mean an LPAR. That is a logical partition that's on one or more of these machines, and the coupling facilities are functioning as high-speed shared memory. They operate a coupling facility control code, which you can think of as a skinny version of the operating system. And that coupling facility control code manages the memory into three types of structures. One is a lock structure, which will manage locking. The other is a cache structure, which manages data that's being shared. And the third is a list structure, which keeps track of status information for the different users around the sysplex. Now, in this picture, you can't tell which LPAR, which machine contains a CFL PAR. And they could be on any one of these boxes. You can have two, three, four, whatever, and they could be anywhere. They could be on their own machine or machines. Wherever the CFL PARs are, they have to be able to link to each of the other images, each of the other ZOS LPARs in the configuration, and they can do this through CF links. The coupling facility links are high-speed links, either fiber or copper, depending on your distances, and they allow that high-speed access we've talked about. To define all the resources, not only the hardware and the connections, but also the structures, we need to have a coupling facility resource management policy. The CFRM policy will generally be managed by the folks who support ZOS. So those of us who deal with DB2 will provide them our requirements, and they'll code it up and start the policy. And all of this is being managed by Cross-System Extended Services, or XES, which is part of the operating system. XES is the component of ZOS that provides the API to go talk to the coupling facility. So anytime DB2 or RLM actually make a coupling facility request, that request is going through XES to get to the coupling facility. All right, so that's our infrastructure upon which all this is going to be based. And as you can see here, all the DASD is accessible by all the LPARs on all the machines in the parallel sysplex. Now let's move on to page 8. Now, there are a couple basics in terms of definitions that we have with DB2 data sharing. The first is a DB2 data sharing group. So the basic unit, if you want to call it, is a group of multiple DB2 subsystems, but once they're in a group, we're going to call them members. So two or more DB2 members sharing a single catalog and directory. You can think of this as a single DB2 subsystem that has outgrown a single machine and now, you know, inhabits multiple machines at once. And what's running in one LPAR is a DB2 member, and what's running in another LPAR is a DB2 member, and together they access the same catalog and directory. Each member will have its own active and archive logs. Each member will be able to read the other member's active and archive logs. And they will manage the active and archive logs using a log record sequence number based on the time of day that they get from the sysplex timer, rather than by relative byte address, because each DB2 member's log will be at a different relative byte address, And so the key is to use the LRSN. And, of course, the DB2 system data in the catalog and directory and all the user data that people are trying to access are going to be on shared disk. Now, from DB2's perspective, the coupling facility contains three types of structures. There is one lock structure per data sharing group. There is one shared communications area, or SCA, per data sharing group. And there are multiple group buffer pools per data sharing group. One group buffer pool for every local buffer pool that contains shared data. And then, of course, GBP0 to manage group buffer pool 0 access is required. So if you happen to have tables and indexes in buffer pools 10, 11, and 12 that will be shared by multiple members in your group, you will define group buffer pools 10, 11, and 12. If you have data in group buffer pool 4 and 5 that is not being shared, that's only accessed by a single DB2, then you don't have to define group buffer pools for those buffers. Moving on to page 9. To make data sharing work, and this is true whether it's DB2 or IMS or anybody else who wants to share data, there are two critical factors. And these factors are concurrency and coherency. So inter-system concurrency control, which in DB2 we'll generally call global locking, is the ability to make sure that nobody is changing the exact same row of data at the same time. Right? So what we'll do here is we'll allow multiple readers of a row, or we'll allow one writer. Except for the case of uncommitted read, we're not going to allow someone writing, someone to have access to change a row at the same time that someone else is reading the row. Right? This is like DB2 101. It's just we're managing it across multiple members now. So that's concurrency control or global locking. The other thing that's critical to performance in a data sharing environment is coherency control. That is, how do we manage the data that's been shared? If multiple members have data rows in their buffers and one of the members changes that data, how do we get the other members to find out that the data has changed? So that's coherency control. And data sharing overhead is the CPU that's required to manage coherency control and concurrency control. That overhead can consist of thousands to tens of thousands of messages per second, and we want to make sure we manage those effectively so as not to give too much overhead. And part of what we'll be talking about is how DB2 data sharing keeps that message rate low. So our data sharing performance goals, when Poughkeepsie and the Silicon Valley Lab were designing all this, they had three major goals. The first is that there will be little or no performance impact if we're not actually sharing data, right? If there's no inter-DB2 read-write interest for a set of data, then we don't want to have very much overhead at all. And one of the requirements here is that DB2 be able to dynamically recognize when sharing is going to occur and not pay the overhead until that happens. So the second point is that the overhead that is incurred is minimal and acceptable. So if we do have inter-DB2 read-write interest, that we have a minimal level of overhead and that we can make that at a level that's acceptable as we start moving this workload across multiple images. Now, the overhead will vary based on different workload characteristics, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And the third point was that we want to achieve near linear scalability when we go past the second member. So when you go from non-data sharing to two-way data sharing, that is, you have two DB2 members, that's when you pay the most of your overhead, is adding that second member. When you start adding members 3, 4, 5, and 6, you'll see very little change in overhead, less than 1%. And that's key to the success of data sharing. So let's talk about how we do this and how we keep this overhead low. So this chart on page 11 shows inter-system concurrency control. So with DB2 data sharing, we have two nodes. Each one is requesting a lock on a different resource. And instead of messaging between each other and communicating between each other which locks they have and which ones they don't, they use this coupling facility and the lock structure in the coupling facility. And as you see here, when lock A, when transaction 1 in node 1 wants lock A, it makes a request and doesn't have to wait. Right? It gets the response back from the lock structure in a matter of microseconds and then proceeds. When transaction 2 in node 2 requests lock B, it also gets response back from lock structure within microseconds. It doesn't have to wait for node 1 to say, oh, I understand you now have this. Now, the only time we get additional traffic is if they're both going after the same resource. And then we'd expect them to have to deal with lock contention. But if they're not contending, then there's no contention, and we get very high-speed access. Now, one of the things that's important here, one of the benefits, is that we're not going to increase the cost of obtaining the locks as we add additional members. So this is what's going to support our scalability. On page 12, we've got the simple view of coherency control. That is, how do we keep track if multiple nodes have the same data buffered? How do we make sure that each of them knows when that data has changed? So here's a simple version. You see in node 1, transaction 1 is getting ready to update page 1. And node 2 also has interest in page 1. So in node 2, when transaction 2 goes to read page 1, it has to register it. And it registers its interest in that page with the group buffer pool out in the CUP facility. And again, that registration is the matter of microseconds. Now, transaction 1, which already had page 1, makes some sort of update to page 1 and then commits that update. And as part of the commit, or before, page 1 will be written out to the group buffer pool. So the new version of page 1 will be available out in the group buffer pool for whoever needs it next. At the same time, DB2 is going to send a cross-invalidate. That's what that XI stands for. It's a cross-invalidate message. The cross-invalidate message is sent via the hardware to node 2, not to DB2, but to the hardware storage area in node 2, and it sets a bit that corresponds to the page frame where page 1 resides over on node 2. So as part of commit processing, we get this non-interrupt that runs over to node 2 to set a bit. Transaction 1 hasn't had to wait for this. It waits to make sure the page is written to the group buffer pool and sends the XI, and then it's done, and the commit is complete. Later on, when transaction 2 gets ready to use page 1, buffer manager will do a get page, and as part of the get page, it'll branch down to the HSA and check the bit. And if the bit is on, then it says, oh, I need to go to the group buffer pool and get the new copy of page 1. And so, again, with microsecond access, it's going to go out to the group buffer pool and bring in that page, and it now has seen the change that transaction 1 made without having to communicate directly with transaction 1. Moving on to page 13, even in the early days of data sharing, we were able to prove this scalability point. As you see here, the ideal scalability is that 45-degree red line, and up to 8 nodes, we see hardly any fall off, right? Less than 4% fall off in that scalability. Moving on to page 14, I want to spend a little more time talking about the DB2 structures and how DB2 uses them, because that'll help us as we get further into this conversation. This is an idealized diagram, if you will. We've grouped all the coupling facility structures together into one box, although realistically they would be allocated on at least two coupling facilities. And we have two DB2 members here, DB2A and DB2B, each with an IRLM. So the DB2A and IRLM A on the left are in one LPAR, and DB2B and IRLM B are in another LPAR. And this is a simplified version because we only have two buffer pools described. And you'll see that buffer manager is using group buffer pool 0 to manage updates that are made to buffer pool 0 in each of the two members. And similarly, group buffer pool 3 is used to manage changes to local buffer pool 3 in DB2A and B. So it's buffer manager that's doing that work. So DBM1, is who's connecting to the group buffer pools. Now, the list structure, the shared communication area, or SCA, which keeps track of the database status information, is being accessed by the master address space, right? So MSTR. And then, of course, IRLM is the one that's trying to access the lock structure. As I move forward to page 15, I've got a brief description of each of the structures. The shared communications area is maintains group-wide status information. So recovery pending, copy pending, check pending, those kinds of messages. If pages need to be added to the logical page list, if they couldn't be written to the group buffer pool or to DASDI when they were supposed to be, they get put on a logical page list. All that information is kept in the shared communications area. And, of course, things like the bootstrap data sets and the system checkpoints and all of this there. And the thing about the SCA is it's really not a performance concern. It's availability concern. The SCA's primary function is to give information to the members of the group about status so that they'll know what's available for use. The lock structure on page 16 is going to be a much more significant player for performance. IRLM uses the lock structure to manage global locking, like we talked about before. This is concurrency control. And it actually has two functions, two kinds of locks that it uses. L-locks, or logical locks, do the concurrency control. We also use the lock structure to track coherency. That is, we're using P-locks, physical locks, to keep track of when data is going to be shared and when we need group buffer pools to get involved. And we're going to track that with PLOCs in the lock structure. Now, the way the lock structure is organized is that it has two parts. It has a lock table, sometimes called a hash table. Those are either 2-byte or 4-byte or 8-byte entries, depending on how many members you have in your data sharing group. And all those do is they correspond to a hash value. So any resource that IRLM is trying to manage is going to, its resource name in DB2 is going to go through a hashing algorithm and end up with a hash value. And when the IRLM wants to communicate locking information with the lock structure about that resource, it sends lock information to the hash class that corresponds to that hash value. And so we can very quickly find out if a resource is being locked just by referring to one very small hash entry in the lock structure and get a response back, is it available or is it not available, in a matter of microseconds. So that's what the lock table does. The other part of the lock structure is a modify lock list. Now this has much more information about locks, but it's only about locks that represent changes. So insert, update, delete kinds of locks, X locks. So when the IRLM has a lock, is holding a lock for DB2 that has an X-type mode, then there's going to be a lot of information in the lock structure in the modify lock list about that lock, much more than just 248 bytes. These are going to be more like 140-byte entries. And what these are used for is in the case that we have a failure, an LPAR fails or DB2 fails or IRLM, anything that's protected by an X-lock is something that's been undergoing change. And we can't let anyone else access that resource until we've resolved what the change is and whether or not it was committed. So in the case of those kinds of failures, the lock that's in the modify lock list becomes a retained lock, which means it's a lock that's held for a period of time until DB2 can resolve what happened to it. And no one else will have access to the data protected by that lock until that resolution is made. Page 17 describes group buffer pools briefly. Again, DB2 uses the group buffer pools to manage buffer coherency. So buffer coherency is keeping track when more than one DB2 has a page in its buffers. How do we keep track that one DB2 has changed it and the others need to update their version of that page? Now, another function is to cache changed pages, right? If I make a change to page 1, and then I want to put that page back out into the group buffer pool so that other members in the data sharing group who have interest in page 1 can retrieve it quickly, in a matter of microseconds, from the group buffer pool rather than from DASDI. We can also optionally cache read-only pages. It isn't necessary only the cache pages that are being changed. We could have control tables, small tables that everyone accesses, and we can keep those tables in the group buffer pool for speedy access and not have to dedicate space for them in our local pools. Now, to do this work, the group buffer pool is broken into two parts. There are directory entries and data entries. The directory entries are those things that dbt uses to manage coherency, because each directory entry will track the interest in a data page or an index page by any member in a data sharing group. So for an object that is being shared, let's call it tablespace Fred, any db2 that has interest in page 13 of Fred will be represented in one directory entry that corresponds to page 13 of Fred. And any db2 that's read in page 27 of an index will have an entry for the directory entry that points to page 27 of that index. Data entries are the actual cached pages that a db2 member has changed. And when we think about this, these could be data pages or index pages. So if we're caching changed pages and I make a change to page 13 of Fred, then I'm going to put that page out there and it's going to consume a data element in the group buffer pool. Page 18 talks about castout. Now, I haven't described castout yet. All I've been talking about so far is updating pages that are shared objects and putting those pages in the group buffer pool. Well, at some point, we need those pages to go out onto disk, to be hardened onto disk, because we're not going to be interested in them forever, and they need to be hardened. So db2 is going to write them out to DASD in a process called castout. And we're not going to use the local buffer pools to manage castout. There's a special castout buffer, and one of the DB2s will be responsible for casting out the pages of an object. And it'll gather those pages up periodically and write them out to DASD. And what controls how frequently that happens is a number of different items that are listed here. Right? There are class thresholds and group buffer pool thresholds that are set when we define our group buffer pools. There are group buffer pool checkpoints. And every time we take a checkpoint, we'll drive the cast-out process. If the two DB2 members stop being interested in the object, then we'll cast all the pages out for that object so it's no longer being shared. And then if we rebuild a group buffer pool and we rebuild it into a smaller group buffer pool, then the pages that don't fit have to be cast out because they have to be protected. Because at the time that an updated page is in the group buffer pool, that may be the only place that that updated page is. Of course, the updates are reflected on the logs. But as soon as I've sent my updated page out to the group buffer pool and I commit, the page I have in my local pool is available for stealing. So it could be that the latest update is out in the group buffer pool, and we're going to use the castout process to make sure that update is reflected back out onto DASD. All right, so page 19 just gives us another picture where we can put all the things we've been talking about so far into one view. At the top, we have the coupling facilities that we're using for the high-speed access. We have the sysplex timers to give everyone the same view of what time of day it is. We have our DB2 members in the center here, each with an IRLM managing locks, and each with pages in their buffer pools. They might be empty pages waiting for use. They might be pages that have been updated recently. They might be pages that are invalidated, right? And so we're going to manage those with the group buffer pools. And then each of the DB2 members will have access to the DASD. And you see there each DB2 has its logs. And over on the right-hand side within the orange rectangle, there's the single catalog and directory for all the DB2 system tables and, of course, the user databases. Now, I talked about the way we keep we limit messages when we're trying to handle concurrency and coherency. But I also mentioned that there are a number of things that data sharing performance will vary depending on. And so let's talk about that a little bit. The cost, the CPU cost of data sharing will vary on coupled facility access, both for locking and caching data. So in other words, the lock structure and the group buffer pool structures are going to play an important part in how well our data sharing environment performs. So, coupling facility access, hardware configuration, and lock contention rates. Now, coupling facility access itself is made up of a number of components, each of which will vary depending on your workload. So, for example, how much time does your application spend in DB2? The more time it spends in DB2, the greater the chance that data sharing will have an impact on it. The less time it spends in DB2, the less impact data sharing will have. How much read versus write are you doing? Are you sharing lots of objects for read only, which is very inexpensive, or are you sharing a lot of objects for write, which would be a little more expensive? How many locks do you request? Each time you send a lock request to the coupling facility, that's going to be some overhead. That's a message, and the host processor generally waits for that message to come back, and that wait is counts as CPU busy. The host processor is generally not dispatched for other work. So how many locks you request and how many trips you make to the group buffer pool will affect your overall CF access and therefore the cost of data sharing. How often do you access shared data? How much insert and delete are you doing? And even what release of DB2 will also have an effect on your coupling facility access. So version 8 has made big steps in reducing the number of trips to the coupling facility for your normal data sharing workload. So your release of DB2 can have an effect too. Hardware configuration will have an effect on the cost because the faster your coupling facility, the less time your requesting host is going to wait for the response and the less CPU overhead he's going to pay. And then, of course, lock contention rates. I mentioned that if I have a lock request and there's no contention, then I'm not doing any waiting and there's no messaging between IRLMs. But if I do have lock contention, then that contention has to get resolved. And resolving lock contention is going to cost overhead. So the cost of data sharing is going to vary on all these things, and this means that the data sharing cost will vary significantly from one workload to another. Now, a typical workload in a two-way environment would involve something like 10% overhead. Now, what this realistically means is if I have an existing workload running in, you know, one LPAR with one DB2, and without changing the workload, I bring in another DB2 on another LPAR, and I spread the work across, that I'm now looking that the overall MIPS required to manage this is going to increase by about 10%. Once I have the second member, then, of course, I'll be able to run more work, and I'll have the higher availability and increased flexibility. But making that first step is going to be about 10%. If I look at individual jobs or individual transactions, I may not see that 10%. It could be less. It could be more. Just, for example, the IRLM itself will go up significantly more than 10%. But then again, the IRLM is a very, very small component of that overall system workload that's managing this DB2 activity. And then the final bullet here says, once I get past two-way and I start adding third, fourth, and fifth members, each one will contribute, this is what we've measured, less than 0.5% additional overhead. So once you pay the additional overhead, the first overhead for two members, additional members are at hardly any cost at all, and that's what makes this scalable. Page 21 shows you some examples of what customers have run into. Now, this is a few years old, but it gives you an idea of what's going on. We've got the industry types on the left, the transaction manager and the database manager. So some of these are doing both IMS data sharing and DB2 data sharing. The number of ZOS images, the coupling facility access per millions of instruction. So you see, typically, the higher amount of overhead corresponds to greater numbers of coupling facility accesses per millions of instructions that you perform. And these are based on typical customer workloads, not what we just run in the lab. So we're still saying, 10% is a reasonable number for planning purposes. All right, let's talk about availability. Because while performance is important, I hope I've convinced you that we've done a good job of designing the entire data sharing and parallel sysplex infrastructure to provide the data sharing benefits with minimal performance impact. Now let's look at some of the availability benefits and how that's going to work. So parallel sysplex and DB2 data sharing are designed to eliminate most single points of failure. So whether it's a DB2 subsystem or a ZOS system or a footprint itself, the CPC is a central processing complex or a central electronic complex, whatever your favorite word is, or even I/O paths. So if we eliminate single points of failure, that's going to do the most we can to achieve high availability. So our goal is to provide continuous availability across planned or unplanned outages of any single hardware or software element. So we're going to provide application availability across failures of a single element, and that's important. So the strategy to achieve this is to remove all causes for planned outages, and then for unplanned outages to build on the legacy of robust fault-tolerant MBS components, and in case we do encounter failure, isolate the failure to the lowest level possible, and then automate the recovery and make the recovery fast. So what does this look like? Well, let's start with DB2 member outage, and let's start by talking about planned outages, because we're still going to have planned outages. Right? Occasionally, we'll roll in some maintenance, or we might be making changes to the hardware where the DB2 is running or the operating system where the DB2 is running, and so we're going to have to take that DB2 member out of the data sharing group. And how are we going to manage this? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to roll the maintenance in. And the idea is that we'll stop one member of our data sharing group and apply the maintenance to it while the other members remain up handling application workload. And they'll pick up the slack while the one member is down, and then when we're done applying the maintenance, we bring the first member back up and bring the second member down. And so we can shift the workload back and forth across the members as we roll our maintenance across through our DB2s. Now, for batch work, we can do a similar thing. We can just have the batch work scheduled to run on the other LPARs where the DB2s are available. Now, this doesn't just apply to DB2 outages. We can do this whether we're making hardware changes or operating system changes. The idea is we quiesce the workload on one DB2 and its corresponding LPAR, move all the workload elsewhere, apply the maintenance, bring DB2 back in, and then move the workload back. Now, the last bullet's important. The key to success in making all this happen, to keeping those applications available, is that the applications themselves must be available to run on more than one DB2 member. If they are tied specifically to DB2A and cannot run on B or C, then when A comes down, the application's down. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So the applications have to be available to run on more than one DB2. Now, from a DB2 access itself, as long as we make the appropriate definitions when we go into data sharing, that won't be a problem. But if that application has access to, non-database kind of data, like maybe a sequential file or something like that, if the application has external sources it needs that are tied specifically to that LPAR, that's going to make it very difficult for that application to be transportable. All right, page 24 talks about DB2 release migration. This is a special case of what we just went through. This is a planned outage that's going to affect one member of the group at a time. And the idea here is to keep the DB2 data sharing group available and applications executing across release migrations. So a data sharing group can tolerate two release levels at a time. Right, we can have coexistence of release N and release N plus 1. So, for example, there are customers who are going from version 7 to version 8 and keeping the data sharing group available while they do that. This does, of course, add complexity to the migration plan, and there's a lot of details in the planning and administration manual. And the process, fundamentally, for release migration is you apply the special programming enhancement that allows release toleration to each member, and then restart each member. And once each member in the group has the SPE, then you put the new release in, using your standard SMPE process, and then you stop and start one member, and it is now running on the new release. And then when you're ready, you stop and start the next member, and pretty soon all the members in your data sharing group are running on the new release. As part of this process, we only do catalog migration once for the data sharing group. Right? There's one catalog directory, and that migration process happens once. Page 25, I'm sorry for the delay, I had a problem paging forward. Page 25 shows the other kind of a DB2 member. What happens if we have an unplanned outage? Well, the diagram here shows the lightning bolt affecting DB2A. And again, DB2B and C and however many else we have in our data sharing group are still going to be up and running and still be able to handle applications. So the architecture allows the other members to handle application workload because they still have access to all the data. The work can be dynamically routed away from the failed member. Again, this assumes that the applications can run elsewhere. Now, the failed member, DB2A in this case, will hold retained locks for any of those resources that were being changed. And if they were in the middle of a change at the time that DB2 failed, we can't allow DB2B to have access to that particular row until we figure out what happened, right? Was it an update? Was it an insert? Did it succeed? Did it fail? So we need to restart DB2A as quickly as possible so that we can go through figuring out what happened, apply its logs, and either abort or commit the change that was in process. Now, part of the operating system is the Automatic Restart Manager, or ARM, and it can automatically restart DB2 members. And if it's a case that we had an LPAR failure and we need to restart that DB2 on another LPAR, because we can do that a lot faster than bringing up the LPAR, then we can use Restart Lite to bring DB2 up with a minimal configuration and quickly go through and resolve any retained locks. And that'll keep their applications up and running on all the other members. Okay, now, so we've talked about DB2 and how we can do rolling maintenance and how we can handle unplanned outages that affect a DB2 member. But what about these new things called coupling facilities? Well, on page 26, we talk about an outage that might affect a coupling facility. So there are two kinds of outages, again, planned and unplanned outages. In the case of a planned outage, if we're going to take a coupling facility and put in, say, a new level of the coupling facility control code, or we're going to add storage or processors to the machine where the coupling facility runs, then we have a planned situation. We just issue a rebuild command. Part of ZOS is commands that interact with the coupling facility, and we issue a command to rebuild all the structures from coupling facility 1 onto coupling facility 2. And this happens with no outage to the data sharing group. And when we're done doing whatever it is we wanted to do to the coupling facility there, then we move all the structures back. So we can do this without any of the DB2s going down, without any of the applications being aware of what happened. Now, in the case of an unplanned outage, and it is possible that someone could drive a forklift into a coupling facility, believe it or not, it's happened. So in case of an unplanned outage, the system's responsible for automatically recovering the lost structures. So typically the way that will work is that the lock and the SCA structures will dynamically be rebuilt into an alternate coupling facility. And back when we did the coupling facility definitions, we allowed enough white space, spare CF capacity on another LPAR to be able to rebuild a lock in the SCA. So if we lose CF1, and that happens to be where DB2 had its lock structure and its SCA, the surviving DB2s, since they're all surviving, will talk amongst each other and rebuild the structure. Between them, they can repopulate all the information that's there, and they rebuild it into CF2, and there's no outage to the group. Group buffer pools, we don't want to deal with that way. Group buffer pools, we want to have duplex. We want to have group buffer pool 0 to have a presence on CF1 and a presence on CF2. And in the case that we lose CF1, all the DB2 members just use group buffer pool in CF2. And we'll talk about that a little more on the next chart. Starting in DB2 version 7, we've also allowed duplexing of the lock and the SCA. But except for a certain configuration, duplexing the lock in the SCA is not necessary for the highest availability. And we'll talk about that in a minute, too. So, two kinds of duplexing. What are they? And this is where lots and lots of people have lots and lots of questions, so it's important to talk about this. User-managed duplexing is the kind of duplexing that affects group buffer pools. And user, in this case, means DB2. User managed from XCS perspective. So DB2 is the user. And in this case, DB2 is responsible for keeping track of group buffer pool 0 primary and group buffer pool 0 secondary. Right? So the primary structure is what it uses mostly, and the secondary structure has some additional information so that if the CF with the primary structure on it fails, DB2 can stay up and all the members can keep going and we don't have an outage situation for the applications. So DB2 is responsible, so it's user-managed. And this is something we want everyone doing data sharing to do. System-managed duplexing is different. In this case, system-managed means system, ZOS, XCS, the operating system. So the operating system in this case, XCS, would be responsible for managing two structures in different CFL parts. This applies in DB2's case to the lock in the SCA. DB2 is not aware that there are two structures out there directly. right? It still makes standard calls to the API that XCS provides, and XCS knows that there are two structures and manages all the traffic to these two structures to make sure that all of the requests are reflected in both of the structures before the request is complete. Now, this is recommended only if you're running coupling facilities in integrated internal coupling facilities. That is, if they're running on an LPAR on the box with multiple other LPARs, and that LPAR is co-resident on a machine with the DB2 member in the same data sharing group. What we're trying to avoid is a double failure scenario. Remember when I first talked about the high availability goals, it was to avoid the outage to a single element. Well, the single element in this case, lock or SCA, if we have the lock or the SCA residing on an LPAR with the same machine as a DB2 member, and we happen to lose the machine, let's take the forklift again. Drive a forklift into a machine, and we lose a CFL PAR with a lock of the SA and a DB2 member. Now we've lost two elements, not one. And losing two elements is a much more complex situation, and that's not going to be pretty. So if we have the lock and the SA on ICFs, and they're co-resident with DB2 members, then we want to duplex them. But there's a cost for this. The cost is going to be significant for the lock structure, not the SCA, and it's significant because we rely on the lock structure to provide us good performance, and each of those synchronous lock requests is going to be at least four times the cost that it was before. So whatever microseconds we were talking about before, multiply that by four. So that's the cost. So this is not necessarily recommended for everyone who does data sharing. It'll all depend. All right, page 28. I've got a little more information about group bar full duplexing. Again, we're going to have the primary group bar full that we do most of our interaction with, and then there will be a secondary group bar full on another CF. The changed pages that DB2 writes to group bar full will be written to both, and that's because the changed pages are those things we have to protect by the group bar full. In the case of a loss of connectivity to the group bar pools, or case of a loss of the group bar full structure, DB2 will switch to the secondary, and this will be done in a matter of seconds. There's no rebuild required because the changed pages are already there in the second CF, in that secondary group buffer pool structure. So the only thing we have to do is rebuild the directory entries, and we can do that over a period of time. And applications aren't going to notice or aren't going to experience an outage. There may be fairly insignificant response time elongation for a brief period of time, but the applications will stay up. And unless we lose both the primary and the secondary group bar pools, the applications will not experience an outage. So this, even as early as version 5, when we first introduced group bar pool duplexing, we were able to document the difference. If you look here on page 29, the blue data points represent group bar pool duplexing, and this is transactions per second. So we're close to 2,000 transactions per second, and then we had a failure, right? There's a failure just a little bit past halfway along the timeline, and you can see that the application throughput dropped for about 20, 30 seconds, and then it picked right back up to where it was before in the case of group bar full duplexing. Of course, if we only had one group bar full and we lost it, the application immediately dropped down to no access because it's relying on this data, and we're going to have to go do some data recovery before the application can be available again. So we like group bar pool duplexing. It's the way to get high availability in our data sharing environment. So I've been talking about configurations and coupling facilities and internal coupling facilities, and on page 30, I've got a quick diagram so you can see what they look like in very basic terms. So configuration A would be a traditional configuration. This is how we first started out. There are two DB2s on different nodes. There are two external coupling facilities. Configuration B has two DB2s on different nodes, one external coupling facility, one internal coupling facility. Figure C has two DB2 nodes, and on the same machines are two internal coupling facilities. And then finally, on D, I've done a slightly different one. There are customers who are doing this where they have more than two footprints on their floor, and they take advantage of this to use internal coupling facilities, but to still maintain isolation. So in configuration D, ICF02, if it contained a lock in the SCA, it would not be co-resident with the DB2 members, and we would not need to have to protect protect from a single point of failure, I'm sorry, double point of failure, by having duplex the lock in the SCA. So configuration D is actually a special case of configuration B, right? Even though there's two ICFs, it's actually behaving like B because the lock in the SCA can be independent from the footprints where DB2A and B are running. So on page 31, I give you a little more verbiage for each of those. A, I would call the traditional environment, right? Lock and the SCA are in one CF, and the group ruffle pools are duplexed, and the primary and secondary group ruffle pools will be spread based on load, based on how much activity they have to keep the coupling facility load balanced. In configuration B, we've got one internal coupling facility and one external coupling facility, and the lock and the SCA would be in the external one, and again, the duplex group ruffle pools would be spread across based on load, and it would be a small performance advantage to the DB2 member that ran where the ICF was running for primary group ruffle pools. And then in configuration C, where we have two internal coupling facilities, in this case, we would want to duplex the lock and the SCA so that we did not, on the failure of either the left or the right footprint, enter into a double failure situation. All right. So I've talked about the different characteristics that allow us to keep high availability in a data sharing environment. Now, there are a number of other things that kind of fall under systems management that I want to talk about as far as how to manage this whole environment, because we're talking 2, 3, 4, 5 machines, multiple LPARs and multiple DB2s. And the idea is, and this is on page 32 now, the idea is that we will have a single system image. So, for example, from being attached to a single system, we can send DB2 commands either to the whole group or to individual members of the group without having to be logged on to each of those systems. Transaction managers and batch jobs can attach to DB2 by referring to a group attach name and not having to know the specific DB2 member to which they're going to attach. Because there is one catalog and one directory, things like DDL, data definition and binding, happen at the group level. Utilities run across the group. Authorization is at the group level. And the entire data sharing group looks like one location name for the purposes of distributed access. Right? This is just a big DB2 that lives on a lot of LPARs, and it's going to have one location name. Now, starting in version 8, there is a way to provide subset access if you specifically want to keep distributed access away from some members. You can define the other members with a location alias and keep distributed access away, but fundamentally it's a single location, and we're just doing some definitional things to allow segregating the DDF workload because it can sometimes be unpredictable. And then there's group scope. You can get display output for the entire group, and online performance monitors will display information for the entire group. Moving on to page 33, I've got a few charts here about dynamic workload balancing. So the key to, we've talked about this several times, the key to balancing the workload across the environment is to take advantage of Workload Manager. Workload Manager is part of the operating system, and it's aware of what's going on. It manages goals, performance objectives based on goals, and it's going to communicate with each of the different transaction managers or workload manager, CICS or IMS or WebSphere, or it'll communicate with DDF requests as they come in to determine where the work should go. In the case of CICS, the best way to do this is using KixPlex Systems Manager, which will manage work between the TORs and AORs that CICS has, and then based on how the work is flowing through CICS, it'll go to those AORs that are best able to handle the load, and of course the AORs are attached to a local DB2 member. IMS does things similarly. With IMS, you can have shared message queues if you're using IMS Transaction Manager. And so by sharing the queues, whichever one is performing well will end up getting more work, and overall your throughput will be increased. If you're running batch message processing regions, again, you can attach those. You can dispatch those where the capacity is, and those can attach using group attach name to DB2. If you're using WebSphere, again, WebSphere, depending on whether you're on WebSphere running on Z or WebSphere on another platform, will determine which of these, how best you're going to take advantage of workload balancing. But the example I've got here on the next page with connection pooling and connection concentration shows an off-platform WebSphere being able to take advantage of multiple members in a data sharing group and to be able to balance the workload and get the best performance and be able to manage all the things we talked before about when DB2 members go in and out of the group, and WebSphere applications will stay up and running and connected. Distributed access through DDF takes best advantage by using dynamic virtual IP addressing, and I've got a chart about that later, and that's both WebSphere and the distributed access can take advantage of Sysplex Distributor. So here's my WebSphere chart. So the major rectangle shows a WebSphere application server, and we've got the resources inside and the database connection pool at the bottom there in yellow, and then we've got the three logical connections that are being managed, and then you see those connections being concentrated down to transport 1 and transport 2, which can then manage pooled connections to the members of the data sharing group. So depending on what's going on at the data sharing group level, you can have members go in and out of the Plex for maintenance or whatever, and you can maintain your WebSphere applications because they don't see directly into DB2. They're going through either the logical connection or the transport, and so we can use those to manage where the connections are active. Similarly, if you go to page 35, here's a DDF example where we've got Sysplex Distributor and a Dynamic VIPA. So whether it's a single workstation running the universal driver or a version of DB2 Connect, or several workstations that are going through a Connect server, in either case, the idea is that the first connection goes through the Sysplex Distributor to find out which DB2 members are available and which one they should attach to based on the current workload. And from that point forward, additional connections will be made based on latest information, because DB2 will continually send information back to either the DB2 Connect server or the universal driver to say, you know, here's what the latest status is. So additional connections can be made either to DB2A or to DB2B or to DB2C. And once you've got this going, then I can take DB2A out of the environment, and as these transactions or interactions end, subsequent connections will be made to DB2B or DB2C, and the users out here won't need to know that any of this happened. The only time that's not true is if there is a communications failure in the midst of a transaction. If I've got a two-phase commit process going on and something happens in the midst of it, then my workstation is going to have to reconnect to the same DB2 that he was talking to before. But again, when we restart that DB2 on another LPAR and we then have access to it again, we're getting right back to it. So we have a lot of access, and we can maintain our high availability and our workload balancing using Sysplex Distributor and Dynamic VIPA. Okay, so that's the basics of DB2 data sharing. I now briefly want to go through some of the common questions that I've encountered over the years, and then we'll point out some other information, and we'll open up for Q&A in just a couple minutes here. So some of the common questions are, I'm on page 36 now, relate to overhead and capacity, application changes, parallelism, operational data versus informational data, or decision support, or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase that, and also what kind of training might be available. So let's talk about overhead and capacity on page 37. I actually had a customer say, you know, I heard I could have as much as 50% overhead if I went to data sharing. Well, I suppose it's theoretically possible to define things so poorly that that happened. But if you have a well-defined parallel Sysplex and a well-defined data sharing environment, And before you got started, you did, you know, due diligence on putting everything together. No, you should see something in the neighborhood of 10%. Now, yes, workloads can vary, and it could be 11, 12, 13, or it could be 7, 8, 9, but 10% is reasonable. And, of course, the what can I expect is it depends specifically on what you're trying to accomplish and how you set it up. And then a lot of questions say, well, you know, how do I go about sizing my structures? I mean, I know I've got to do this work to get these structures. They're so important. How do I know how big to make them? Well, one option is to read the manuals, right? The Data Sharing Planning and Administration Manual has pages and pages about how to size them. But the easier way is to go to this website, to the CF Sizer, and it prompts you to enter information about your current environment, and it'll come back with recommended sizes. And those are generally very good starting points, assuming that your input is valid and represents reasonably heavy workload. Then the structures that you end up sizing should be able to support your workload. All right, another question. This is on page 38. A lot of people, after I tell them all the application interface it protects, say, well, don't I have to change my applications to do this? Because, of course, in other approaches to parallelism or data sharing, the chart where we had the three different approaches, sometimes a lot of application changes have to be made. Fundamentally, the applications don't have to change, right? SQL interface remains the same. You know, your select, insert, update, delete, still stays the same. None of that changes. Now, there are some changes you may want to make. First of all, if you're not committing frequently, if you're not taking advantage of lock avoidance, and you're going to move into data sharing, you're going to want to address that, right? Committing frequently has a long-standing recommendation long before data sharing came along. It's just more important once you get to data sharing. And lock avoidance is even more important in data sharing. Avoiding locks in non-data sharing means reducing the IRLM CPU and perhaps reducing some elapsed time for some transactions. When you used to get into data sharing, lock avoidance means avoiding trips to the coupling facility. So that's significant overhead reduction if you can manage lock avoidance. So isolation cursor stability, or if you can, uncommitted read, will reduce will increase the likelihood that you're avoiding locks. And, of course, in conjunction with isolation cursor stability, you want to be able to use current data node. Now, this has some implications on how you do your application design, but those are all these all correspond to good programming practice. And if you're practicing good programming techniques, then this should not represent a problem. Now, there's another area of change. There are new messages and return codes with data sharing. And assuming you're checking for return codes, you may want to enhance your error handling routines to pick up on some of the new return codes. And finally, the point we made earlier, applications must be able to run on more than one DB2 member to achieve high availability. It won't do the end user out there on the Internet much good if your DB2 is up and your parallel sysplex is up and the group buffer pools and lock and the SAA are all up if the application can't run on another DB2 member that's waiting for work, right? So if the applications can work on multiple members, that's where we're going to get the best advantage. And it's possible that your applications are not written that way. It's possible that they rely on unshareable resources, and if so, then you may have a few changes. But those typically are an exception. All right, moving on to page 39. Some people say, well, now that I've got data sharing, can I do parallelism? Well, parallelism can mean a number of different things. I generally do not think of parallelism when I think of 12 users each executing a different, you know, version of transaction one in a CICS environment or an IMS environment. I don't think of that as parallelism, although it could well be that three of the users are executing on DB2A and four of them on B and five of them on C, and that's how I'm getting my 12 uses in parallel. What I think of parallelism is, in the DB2 language anyway, is what's here on page 39. So can I get parallel access by multiple users using different transactions to their data? Yes. But when I'm talking about what DB2 thinks of as parallelism, let's look at what we have. Version 3, DB2 introduced I/O parallelism, which allowed a single task to process multiple I/O streams. This would reduce the elapsed time by basically, you know, getting a lot more I/O through the system at the same point in time. Starting in version 4, We came out with CP parallelism, that is the ability to have multiple tasks, multiple parallel tasks, under control of SRBs, you know, after being spawned from the same request, each one of which has an IO stream. So this is ancient DB2 stuff. And then starting in version 5, and this requires data sharing, there's sysplex query parallelism. Very complex queries, very complex SQL, can be broken up and have portions of it executed on different members in a data sharing group, and then having the results all brought together and aggregated under one member that made the original request. So now you can see I can really broaden out the I/O streams and really get a lot of I/O and processor resources to go after very complex SQL. So, yes, data sharing allows this kind of parallelism in addition to the kind that has multiple users running, you know, same or similar transactions on different on different machines, different LPARs. People, I'm on page 40 now. People often ask about operational data versus informational data. You know, how does this work with data sharing? You know, what do I have to do differently or the same? Well, the chart on page 40 is what I would consider a more typical configuration, mostly because people were doing it this way before. They had an operational environment, and they would extract data and transform it and put it into another DB2 in their informational environment. And they would have you know, different data rules and different access and different authentication in their decision support environment. And then as everything grew, the operational environment turned into a data sharing group, and the decision support environment turned into a data sharing group, and they transformed data from one to the other. But another way to look at this, another possibility, is pictured here on page 41, and that shows both the operational and decision support systems going after the same data sharing group. The idea here is you would have a set of tables that represent your operational data, another set of tables that represent the decision support aspect, so maybe aggregations or maybe summaries or whatnot, and have them so that the same systems can access both, so that you could have workloads coming in on your operational system that are heavily accessing the operational data, but can also join with summary tables, you know, light access against the decision support data. Similarly, on the right-hand side, you could have your primarily decision support types of workload have occasional access to real-time data and be able to work it that way. And if they're in the same data sharing group, this is very powerful and flexible. Finally, on page 42, people ask, well, what, you know, I want to learn more, and I've already read the book from cover to cover, and can I go to class and have people teach me? And here is information. Some of the classes are currently scheduled. Some of them are not currently scheduled. But if you go out to look at the IBM Learning Services, you can find out what the current schedules are and whether they're scheduled near you. So, DB2 data sharing, and why I think you should consider having it as part of your life, is that the data sharing technology built on parallel sysplex and the coupling facilities provides the base to allow DB2 to deliver continuous availability and nearly unlimited scalability far into the future. It's a proven technology. We've rolled it out in customers since 1995, and we have quite a number of customers running data sharing in production. And the lab still continues to enhance it. There's lots of new things, and version 8 was very exciting with some of the data sharing enhancements. Page 44 is a bibliography. If you have additional questions or if you want to do additional reading, of course, the planning and administration manuals for version 7 and version 8, those are the numbers there. The version 8 has a new release in February. The manual was updated. And then I just put a few red books. There are lots of red books that include data sharing information, but I just put a few, depending on what you might be most interested in, including things like highest availability for your applications or distributed access or TCP/IP in the parallel sysplex. And I'm putting in a plug. There's a new red book that will be coming out soon, and I'll be working with some of my colleagues on producing this red book in August, and so I would hope that by the end of the year you'll see that too. Finally, I'd like to turn this back over to Jim to open this up for questions and answers.
Thank you, Mr. Rader. Today's question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We'll proceed in order that you signal us and take as many questions as time permits. Once again, press star 1 if you have a question, and we'll pause for a moment. And we'll take our first question today from Umesh Mehta with MetLife.
Hi. The question I have is regarding the batch workload. I mean, obviously, there needs to be JCL changes if you know, the JCL is wanting to do a specific LPAR or whatnot. So there are additional changes, I guess, from an application standpoint.
Okay, so the question is, even if my application programs themselves don't change, might I have to change my JCL to get the applications to run where I want it to run?
Correct.
Okay, yes. And that's a good point. I did not discuss JCL. There are a number of options relative to JCL. And a lot of it depends on how you do your operations and how you automate your operations. And every shop is going to be a little different. Fundamentally, the key things in the JCL are how you attach to DB2. And so a lot of batch jobs are going to have a DD card, right, the SysTSYN DD card that will specify a DB2 name.
Right.
If that is a specific DB2 member name, like DB2A, then that job will only run on DB2A. But you can define, and typically part of defining a naming convention is to come up with a group attached name, which is a if you want to call it a generic name, by which you can attach to any of the members in the group. So in our case here, for DB2A and DB2B, I might have my group attached name be DB20.
Okay.
Or DB2P, if I don't have that many members in my group, you need to recognize that it's production. And if your control card has that in it, then you can start that JCL on any of those LPARs, and it'll attach to that DB2. Now, how do you get the JCL to start on a member? Well, that goes back to how whether or not you have a systems affinity in your JCL and whether your scheduling packages allow you to start, you know, jobs on different LPARs. And as soon as we start getting into different scheduling packages and automations packages, then it's out of my bailiwick, and I'm not going to be able to walk you through all those things. But there are a number of ways to both allow it a job to start on multiple members or to restrict it from running on certain LPARs. But I think the key to what you're asking for is the group attached name. Some customers decide to make the group attached name what the original DB2 member name was, and then and then rename the underlying member. So if today you attach to DB2P, they might choose to change DB2P to become DB2A, but all your JCL says DB2P, and that's the new group attached name. So then none of your JCL changes. Other customers do it the other way. Right? We're going to have a new group attached name, or we're going to change all our JCL.
Right. Another question about the WLM. I guess it's part of, ZOS, obviously, the load balancing and whatnot. I mean, there's a lot of configuration there which probably need to be done to balance the workload.
Actually, from a DB2 point of view, there's not a lot of work that has to be done, right? When you set up DB2, you're going to have a bunch of address spaces, right?
Mm-hmm.
DB2A master, DB2A DBM1, and so on,
right?
And DB2B master and DB2B DBM1. The key is to, when you define your workload manager policies, to make sure that the policy definitions address the DB2 address spaces together so that all the members are going after the same performance goals.
Okay.
Right, so DB2A and DB2B and whatnot would generally be going after the same goals, and their corresponding set of address spaces would generally have the same goal. Once you've done that, the only place where you're really going to be having interesting things to do with WLM is when you start looking at stored procedure address spaces, WLM established stored procedure address spaces. And that is, we can spend, you know, an hour or two talking about that alone.
Right.
But as far as just getting the work through, no. WLM will be looking at how the DB2s are running And then the next piece of that, of course, is your DDF workload will also be defined. Right?
Okay.
Workload that comes in from different places gets defined in WLM, and based on how it's defined is how WLM is going to manage it.
Okay. And it can route from LPAR A to LPAR, let's say, B, if LPAR A is busy, correct? Or
well, what's going to happen is on a distributed request, the very first time the connection is made, it's the requester is going to get information back based on WLM information. And the WLM information will allow that first request to say, okay, I'm going to connect to A or I'm going to connect to B. Once that connection is there, DB2 will be feeding back information about what's going on.
Okay.
And so, you know, an additional a specific conversation won't change, but new connections can be made elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
Right? Once I have a particular piece of work, I'll be going back and forth that DB2 until I do something like, you know, depending on my threads, if I do something like a commit, then the next time I might be on a different DB2.
Okay. I mean, the real question is like, you know, applications like PeopleSoft or SAP, you know, they don't really keep the thread, you know, open and they drive the workload. And once they make the connection, I mean...
Well, PeopleSoft and SAP have different ways of dealing with data sharing. That's true.
Okay.
SAP, for example, always the call goes to one DB2, but if there's a failure, then the entire SAP flips over to a backup one.
Okay.
They're not quite as dynamic.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Matthew Rhea with Conseco.
Hi. You might have touched on this with the first question there, but we had a situation where we had a DB2 member fail, and yet our batch jobs kept being routed to that LPAR on that member. And so all our DB2 jobs are failing, even though there was a perfectly good one up and available. And my question was, what part of our systems is responsible for, you know, fixing that kind of problem to make sure that jobs aren't routed to a failed DB2 member?
Okay, so now that's a very good question. That would come in your probably what would be termed a scheduling package.
Okay.
Whatever's handling scheduling is going to know where to send them, and it has to have its own smarts to be able to say whether somebody, you know, whether DB2 is up or not. The part I was describing in the first set of questions happens through distributed access, and distributed access, if you want to think about it that way, it's like millions of little baby batch jobs coming in one after another, and each one of them gets a chance to decide where it's going.
Okay.
In your case, if this, the batch job itself typically isn't going to have the smarts either in the job or in the JCL to say if this, then, and if that, the other, but the scheduling package ought to.
Okay. So it's our scheduler package that has to take that into account and figure out a way to do it.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll now move on to Scott Morrow with the Department of Families and Children in Florida.
Hello, Scott. Are you there?
Mr. Morrow, if you're using your speakerphone, please depress your mute function. Okay, we're not hearing a response. We'll move on to Pius Chu with Consolidated Edison.
Yes, hi. I have two questions. Number one, if I have two DB2s, how would I merge into one single catalog and directory? And the second question I have is, if you have a operational and informational system, how would you resolve the object name that is the same?
Okay, those are two very interesting questions. We'll take them one at a time. If you have two DB2s, and you want to merge them into one DB2, there is a process. There are fundamentally three approaches, right? One approach is that you choose one of the DB2s to go away. You define all of its objects with new DDL, and you do an unload reload, right? That's the long, tedious, but it'll end up being right for sure approach. And then the intermediate approach is you do something like you do a DDL definitions and you do DSN1 copy with OBID or PSID translation, and then you do something similar. And a third approach is that you define, you make sure the disk is shared, of course, and you make the new DDL definition in whichever DB2 is going to become the the data sharing one, and then for those objects that connect to it, you go in and do a repair and flip, you know, make changes in the DBID and PSID. Now that is really fast and prone to error. There are also ways to do this that fit in between those three basic approaches depending on the tools used. IBM has tools, and I wouldn't be surprised if other vendors have tools that allow you to do all of these things without you having to do a lot of mucking about, where you can go through and basically redefine these objects from one system to another and get the data over there too. So it's really going to depend on how long you have to make this happen and, you know, how quickly you want, and then how risk-averse you are. Right, so you're going to be balancing time versus risk and whether or not you've got the tool, the appropriate tools.
Okay. Now,
your second question is a little different, because the second question basically says you've got an operational system, an informational system, and some of the objects in the informational system have the same object names as the one in the operational environment. Same, you know, table names, same column names, and all the rest of that. And you've so far isolated users of each of the systems, either through views or some other way, so that they don't get confused. And so then you're thinking, can I put those back together? And if so, how do I go about doing that? Right? Is that what the question is?
Well, if you have a operational table, right, and basically you want the application, the one application you use that, while on a different subsystem you have exactly the same name, and basically you want to use that, you know, for people doing like an ad hoc type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, maybe one way that you could do that is by, you know, naming the object, if you're going to do data sharing, is naming one set of, let's say, ad hoc table to a different name.
Well, part of the question here would be, are you talking about starting with existing operational and informational data that's separate and bringing them together?
Yes.
Okay. Right. So if you're talking about they're being separate and you want to bring them together, then yes, you are going to have to do something so that the names aren't the same, because the, you know, once you get into the same catalog directory, they have to be unique names.
Right.
And then, so part of the question is, you know, if you're going to take your informational data and put it into a data sharing group with your operational data, all the work that was done before to separate it out, some of that work's going to have to, in effect, be retrofitted, because you're going to have to give it new names. And then the applications are going to have to recognize the new names, or you're going to have to define some interesting views to allow that. Right.
Okay.
So it would be very hard to tell without doing a lot of analysis whether the benefits to having them in the same data sharing group versus separate data sharing groups would be worth the work to put them together, right? There are
mm-hmm.
advantages to having them together, but there would be a lot of effort involved just from, on your point, from a, you know, data modeling and renaming application change point of view.
Okay. Back to the first question, is there any documented material you know, in detail, how to combine the DB2s into one catalog directory?
Yes, from the three simple approaches I described, those are all documented in the DB2 data sharing planning and administration manual.
Okay.
What I cannot give you off the top of my head is the list of which IBM tools fit nicely into those approaches. But I imagine that your local IBM representative would be happy to find that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on which approach you favored, be able to figure out which tools would help you do that.
Okay.
The thing about the tools is it really saves you from making, you know, potential finger checks, and it's really a lot easier to have them help you do it. You don't have to. Back in early data sharing, the tools weren't there to support it, and people did it the hard way. But if you're going to do this, it would be nice to have a tool help you out.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Harry Shangudatasan with Harry's Database Analysis Consulting.
Hello, Mark. Thanks for your presentation.
You're welcome.
My questions relate to the FOIL number 31, parallel sysplex configurations.
Okay. go back there and make sure I know which one it is you're talking about.
So this,
okay.
This is the one with the extra verbiage about each of the configurations.
Right. I'm there.
So, starting off with option number C, two ICF configuration.
Right.
One of the sub-bullets has the sentence saying, hardware structure duplexing or system-managed duplexing. I'm aware of system-managed duplexing. What is hardware structure duplexing?
Actually, way back when this first was introduced, those terms were interchangeable. So some people called them system-managed duplexing. And some people called it hardware structure duplexing.
Okay, two names for the same thing.
Exactly. And when I went through and did the next to final edit on this, I removed the hardware structure duplexing, which I had used over the years, from one of the other charts and neglected to remove from this chart. So if you just remove hardware structure and end up with system managed duplexing, it'll read correctly.
Okay. My next question is the way you have it listed here is the way I think of it as being the proper way of running this configuration. What I was curious was whether you were aware of any site running the two ICF configuration without doing the duplexing of the DB2 structures, and in particular, not doing the duplexing of the lock structure.
I happen to talk to one customer recently who is doing that.
Yes.
And their opinion was they had looked back over time and had decided that the left-hand footprint or the right-hand footprint was unlikely to disappear all at once unless it was a situation where they had even bigger concerns, like the entire building melted, in which case they didn't care. And they were comfortable enough that the machine would stay around and they weren't going to bother, in effect. The problem with that is it isn't necessarily hardware failure that we need to worry about. Because occasionally, I don't know what you want to call it, but the example I have, and this actually occurred a long time ago, it wasn't this configuration, but you imagine the same sort of thing. When it was time to put in I don't remember whether it was additional hardware or a new CFCC release, but they needed to take down one of the coupling facilities, right?
Uh-huh.
And so the systems people at the customer took all the structures off of CF1 and moved them all over to CF2, and then they disabled the link so that nothing would rebuild back, and now CF1 is ready for maintenance. And they said, okay, you can go drop power now. And they pointed, and the guy who was going to drop power thought they were pointing to CF2, and he dropped power on CF2.
Uh-huh.
Now, so this is human error.
Uh-huh.
So the big reason I would still recommend the lock and the SCA being duplexed is not that the machine is likely to fail. It's not that the whole thing is likely to fail. But if something were to happen, if something like that were to happen, or if something weird with the power to the building were to drop power to that box all at once, you would not want to be in that long recovery situation. As long as you're comfortable that none of those things will ever occur, then you don't need to do it. On the other hand, and this is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, when you find that happening, don't call me unless you've been doing duplexing. Because if you're doing the duplexing, then it's not a problem.
To ask it in another way, among the set of customers who have the two ICF configuration, what percent do it what I'll call it the right way, which is duplexing everything?
I do not have – first of all, I haven't worked with enough customers that do that to give you what I would consider a representative answer. Most customers I work with either do configuration B – or they do configuration D, the special case of B, where it's an ICF but on another footprint where like they round robin, like they have three data sharing groups.
Right.
And they trade off which one is where. So I've only talked specifically with the one customer that I know isn't doing the duplexing, and they should.
Right.
There may be others that are doing that, and they just haven't told me.
Oh, okay. Let me ask then slightly a different way.
Okay.
There was a relatively recent Red Book, which was about, which had a title like, Real Life Coupling Facility Performance, are you familiar with that one? Where they had some sort of like benchmark tests, you know, with the various sort of CF configurations?
I believe I have that. I will not admit to having read it recently enough to be able to recall the numbers to mind.
Oh, okay. Because in that, the way I remember it was you know, the particular customer did a test because they were looking at how they wanted to configure. They were already data sharing, but I guess they were going to upgrade or something. And they did tests, and because of the, you know, 4x increase in lock overhead,
mm-hmm.
They decided that they would stick with standalone coupling facilities instead of going to the two, you know, coupling facility configuration. And so I was wondering whether you had any further experience in terms of people who have looked at the two options and have decided to stick with, you know, B or D as opposed to going to C.
Most customers that I see now, and one of my colleagues is the same timing me, and I think she sees the same thing, is most are either in B
yes.
or D.
Right.
Now, the reason people prefer, or the reason some people like C, is I think that there is a cost difference when you order a box. The ICF is already on there, and there are some cost savings to doing it that way. So depending on what your workload is, if you start multiplying, if you do it the right way and duplex the structures and start multiplying that cost over time, at some point the cost of that additional capacity is going to exceed the cost of the standalone box.
Mm, okay.
And so it depends, I suppose, on how big the standalone box has to be and whatnot. Now, my understanding is you can buy the small version and put the lock and the SCA out there, the small version of the footprint, depending on what level of technology you're at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the Z990 or the Z9. But there is a small version that doesn't do much of anything else, but it does just fine as an ICF. As a CF, as a standalone CF. And then the cost isn't so great, and the various heating and cooling and whatnot isn't too bad, and then it's worth it. Part of it depends on how important it is to the customer to get the very fastest response time and, you know, minimal overhead. Because not only does that 4x cost turn into CPU overhead, but it does somewhat, not much, but somewhat elongate response time, because every one of those locks you're waiting for a little bit longer. And so it depends. Now, the other way to look at it that some customers have said is, well, look, 4x what we're paying now seems like a lot, but compared to 2 years ago, it's not that different,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we keep, you know, the speed of lock requests has been dropping since we first implemented data sharing. I don't know how much faster it can get.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. I haven't had that conversation recently.
But
I don't think CF requests follow Moore's law.
There's that problem with the speed of light.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And our next question comes from Bill Hilliker with Aetna.
Hello, Mark. This is
Hey, Bill.
My question has to do with something that we had heard a while back, and I'm not sure where we heard it, that when you go beyond 6 members of a data sharing group, there is the potential for a performance hit within the structures of the coupling facility. Now, you know, page 13 seems to belie that. You have a chart that shows going up to 8 members, and then you mentioned that you know of a customer who has as many as 17 members. So can you talk to that a little bit? Are we getting bad information, or did we get
bad
information?
Well, there's an implication here, right? And one of my implications, with the point that I said, you know, how much is the overhead, and I said, well, it's a well-configured environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hitting on a point when you cross from 6 members to 7 members, that's when the size of the entry in the IRLM, you know, in the lock structure, when the size of the hash entry increases from 2 bytes to 4 bytes. If you do nothing else and you add the 7th member, the IRLM and XCS will automatically rebuild the lock structure, and instead of having, say, 16 million 2-byte entries, you'll have 8 million 4-byte entries. And if you suddenly have half the number of entries, that's radically increased the likelihood that you'll get false contention. And when you increase false contention, again, that's contention, and IRLM has to resolve contention. So the more contention, the more overhead. So, yes, if you do nothing else, and you go from 6 members to 7 members, and you go from 2-byte entries to half the number of 4-byte entries, your false contention will go up, your overhead will go up.
Okay.
But
so what would the something else be, I guess?
The something else would be, at the very least, you know, recognizing this is going to happen and doubling the size of the lock structure so that you end up with the same amount, you know, the same number of entries that you had before. Now, if you're going to double the size of the lock structure, that means you're going to have double the storage.
Mm-hmm.
And how much storage is that? Well, you know, again, it depends. But I would guess that most big customers today are running lock structures for production probably in the 128 megabyte range, with the really big ones in 256 and the exceptional ones, SAP being one of those, perhaps higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 512 or,
yep,
or even closer to a gig. Now, I don't have a price list for coupling facility storage in my back pocket, so I can't tell you what the difference is going to be. But as far as I'm concerned, going from 64 to 128, 128 to 256 meg, when I think about how large group buffer pools are and all the other structures in the CF, doubling the lock size of the lock structure for production doesn't strike me as a big deal. And I would just as soon do that than worry about the performance hit.
So there was something to that that whole thing.
There is definitely something underlying it.
Yep.
Because people didn't necessarily know that it was the switch from 6 to 7 that made that happen. But once
right.
you recognize that, say, well, all I have to do is increase the size of my lock structure, and then I'm fine. And it's just a matter of, do we have enough storage to do that? Depending on what your configuration is, you may already have that kind of spare storage
right.
in the CF waiting to be used.
Right, and off the top of my head, I don't know what we have out there, but you're probably right. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, that's great.
David Berry with United Parcel Service has our next question.
Yes, I have a technical issue here. I don't seem to be able to get the visuals for the presentation. Is there a way I can get them after the fact?
Since I didn't put them out there, I don't know the correct answer, but I'm pretty sure the correct answer is yes, we can get you the visuals after the fact. And in fact, this will be broadcast again, the first part of it. You know, we were recorded, so the recording will be played, and it's going to be available on the web. I don't have that information in front of me, but if you give me an email, I will make sure that you get not only the visuals, but the ability to listen to it again, if that would be helpful.
That's great. Where would I reach you by email?
Mark?
Yeah?
This is Diane. I would suggest that they just have somebody else register, and they'll be sent the visuals. So if they have somebody else in their company, just register for the session, and
oh.
they'll be sent them immediately.
That would be faster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it may be me re-registering.
You can do that as well.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we'll hear from Renee Wilson with Department of Defense in Australia.
My question is relating to not using the workload balancing functionality of data sharing. If I'm only using two members and I'm sending all of my workload to just the one member, unless that one member goes down, can my Sysflex distributor handle that?
I'm sorry. Could you? I'm going to try turning up my volume a little, but if you could try saying that again, I didn't catch the entire question.
Sorry, is that better?
Yes.
My question relates to not using the workload balancing functionality of data sharing.
Okay.
If I wanted to send all of my workload to the one member, unless that one member goes down, can my Sysflex distributor handle that?
So if you want, are you worried about TSO and batch and CICS, or are you just worried about distributed access?
Just the distributed access.
Okay. There are several ways to keep the access to one. The problem is none of those dynamically allow you to flip to the other
okay.
that I'm aware of.
So it would have to be a manual process of changing our jobs to the other member once our first member went down.
Right. We don't really have a way to say at the Sysflex distributor level radically favor this member over that member
so much so that you never go to the other one unless the first one's not there.
Okay.
Right? We there are various manual ways of doing this. Are you running version 7 or version 8?
Version 7.
Version 7. So the best thing, this is very it's not very granular. If you set the member that you do not want to receive access, if you set max DB at equals 0,
yep.
It will not get any access.
Okay.
That's one way. And since that's a ZPerm change, you ought to be able to change it on the fly. The problem is, it all depends on whether you're anticipating a planned outage or an unplanned outage.
Yeah.
Right? If it's a planned outage you're anticipating, then at the time that you're going to take down the member that's supporting all the distributed and sending it to the other one, then what you do is you take the guy who's not getting any and you change his max DBAT equals 0 up to whatever a reasonable number is.
Yeah.
And then you issue your stop DB2 on the other one, and gradually the work will stop going to that one, right?
Okay.
And it'll flop over. But to have them both be up and running and keep all the work going to one, and I don't see a good way to handle the unplanned version without suddenly making a change, which means you could end up with a big blip in availability to your users.
Yes,
if the member that was handling all the work suddenly disappeared.
Okay, so there's no other way around that?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I've had conversations somewhat similar to this with people, where they wanted to prefer one member or another. Now, in version 8, if you had 3 members and you were going to try and keep it to 2 members, then there's some stuff we could do, right? In version 8, we've got we can do location aliases. And so you can define your data sharing group as members, one alias as members 1, 2, and 3, and not include 4 in that location alias. And
mm-hmm.
What that would do then is keep anyone from accessing 4 on a normal basis, and then you could just change the alias definition, and they would never know. But that's still not as dynamic as what you're thinking of, and I don't know of a way of doing it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Judy Ruby Brown with IBM has our next question.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Judy.
Hey, I just thought I would address a question that was asked about that FOIL 31 and configuration B and C.
Okay.
And of the customers that I have seen, I have only seen one customer that did duplexing on the lock and the SCA. Everybody else I have seen has either had configuration B with an external, or they've had a 2ICF configuration, in which case, of course, we always recommended that you need to do one of two things about it, either duplex them or get the external one. And as you pointed out, there's certainly a lot of financial and cabling type issues that we really don't deal with.
Right. So have you seen anyone who's doing the configuration C with 2ICFs who is not duplexing them?
Yes. And that's the bad news.
Yes,
and that's why we recommend, please do something about this. Or, there's a customer we saw back in 1997, and they said, yep, we know that we'll do duplexing of our group buffer pools, but we are willing to accept the risk that we will not lose an entire box. That was their choice. So, in essence, there are 3 things you can do. You can somehow get an external one in whatever manner, and usually it's with a Z890 or Z9BC model.
Right.
Or you can do systems managed duplexing. And as I said, I only have seen one customer that did it, and they did it across 5 kilometers, and their lock access was about 95 microseconds, which is well above about the 15 or 20% that they were expecting, or that
right.
they could have at Simplex. And then when you add distance, all the requests went async, so there were about 225 microseconds across that 3 miles, and they were maintaining 5,400 lock requests a second.
So even with the higher cost, they were still able to manage just fine.
They were managing just fine, but they weren't having, you know, really high lock requests. And just recently I made this recommendation to another customer whose peak time was less than 1,000 lock requests a second.
Right.
But it's typically a few customers in Europe do it, but this is the only customer that I have ever seen, and they were in Latin America.
Okay. So if the gentleman who asked that question is still on, I think the way to net this out would be, if they're willing to take that risk, they can save some, you know, CPU capacity and some cost, but if they ever do lose that footprint, we're talking about an extended, complex outage that is prone to human error.
Right. Well, what they have to be aware of, and more important, make their management aware of, is the fact that they'll lose the entire group. And it may not look too bad if you've got a two-way group, but if you're in six-way, the entire group will come down. Now, you can use your automation to automatically restart in place, and the lock in the SCA structure will be automatically rebuilt, even if that DB2 on the image that failed is still down. We can do that fine, and it should be pretty fast, as long as you have well-behaved transactions that commit frequently. But if you have a rogue application that was running for an hour, for example, and you had the situation, well, now you're in a problem because you've got to read all of that log to recreate the lock structure. So they just need to understand those risks.
Right.
And we prefer, and since we are very big on availability and within the infrastructure, we recommend avoiding the whole situation with an external CF.
Right. Thank you.
Scott Morrow with Department of Families and Children has our next question.
Yes, I have a question about the increased resource utilization and I guess the oversale on availability. My question is the viability of data sharing with version 8 and the constraint relief that's introduced, specifically the utility processing. Most managers believe that they are going to be relieved of that constraint.
Which constraint are you referring to?
The availability constraint. Excuse me, but they're I've had experience with data sharing, and it's extremely complex. With the introduction of version 8 and the overhead, the associated overhead, IBM purports a 10 to 15% increase. And it, with the introduction of data sharing, you're introducing yet another 10 to 15%.
Okay, well, let's separate these things out, okay, one at a time. So, are you currently at version 7?
Currently version 7, going to version 8 within the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay, and you're currently data sharing or
non-data sharing?
You're non-data sharing, and you're contemplating it?
It's being contemplated by management. Management believes that it's going to relieve the constraint of the maintenance intervals that are taken twice a month.
Okay. Okay, so there are two things going on here, right?
Right.
So even if we ignore data sharing for the time being and just think about going your version 7 environment and going up to the version 8 environment, then, yes, the average, whatever that means, right, the average, once you get completely to NFM, the new function mode in version 8,
right,
and you're able to take advantage of the new index capabilities and all this other stuff, then we would anticipate that you would be somewhere in the 10% range of, you know, additional overhead based on going from version 7 to version 8. And there's a whole host of it depends, you know, several pages of them. But, right, okay, so that's the general number, and we've seen customers come in above that and below that based on where they fall on all the it depends items.
Correct.
Now, of all those it depends, one of them has to do with data sharing. Data sharing customers tend to see on the lower side of the 10% from version 8 because some of the version 8 enhancements include fairly significant performance enhancements to coupling facility accesses, both in terms of reduced lock requests as well as batching page access to the group buffer pools. So if you were already a data sharing customer and you measured your workload and then went to version 8, there is a reasonable chance that your number would be less than the 10% going from version 7 to version 8.
But again, that depends upon the workload characterization.
Absolutely. It depends. Again, now we toss in data sharing. Now we have another page of it depends. So, yes, there's a lot of depends there. In your case, if you're looking at starting version 7 non-data sharing and eventually, you know, some number of migratory steps, you end up at version 8 in data sharing, is there a chance that your workload would, you know, two-way data sharing, I'm going to assume for now, is there a chance that your workload cost would be 20% in addition to what it is now? And there is a reasonable chance that it would be. My feeling is that 10% and then 10%, rather than being 20%, you'd be 17 or 18. But, again, it all depends. And so the question then comes back to what your management is trying to accomplish.
Right.
If the – and I don't remember Department of Child and Family Services, I believe.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so does management experience a cost to not being available 2 weekends a month? I mean, is there a budget item that says we can, you know, whatever, our dollars change if we're more available?
Well, of course, that's true. But the majority of the maintenance is reorg processing, resizing of VCM linear data sets for the associated DB2 objects, and that's not going to be resolved by a DB2 data sharing environment.
Data sharing alone is not going to handle the reorgs and VSAM and all that stuff. You're right. What data sharing does is it handles the planned or unplanned outage situations that affect the DB2 subsystem or the LPARs on which it resides or the machine on which they reside. Right. So if their primary concern is things like reorg, resizing, then that kind of availability is addressed more by the version 8 enhancements in schema evolution and that sort of thing, right, and in enhancement, in the utility enhancements, than it is by data sharing, because you can't make something that's being reorged any more available in data sharing than it is in non-data sharing, right? The window where it's going to be unavailable for write and the window where it's unavailable for either, those aren't going to change based on data sharing. Right. That's a valid point.
Okay. I just wanted to gain some clarity on that. One last question. You talked about release migration and that being done while the actual data sharing environment is up.
Mm-hmm.
And you had mentioned there are complexities with the implementation. I'm familiar with the down-level or the down-level function level of IRLM and some of the considerations there. Is there a red book that specifically mentions what those complexities are, which itemizes them? Is that a big depends as well?
Depends
on the implementation.
And
obviously, even if you have early code, you're still going to have to take an IPL.
Well, the thing about early code, early code is, let's take version 7 to version 8.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm running version 7 early code, I can run version 8. If I'm running version 8 early code, I can run version 7. So when you make the early code change is, you know, for the most part, independent of how you're doing the rest of your release migration, right?
Right.
We make sure that you can run the you know, up or down with the early code.
Right.
Right.
Upward, downward compatibility.
Right. So if typically what's going to happen then is I can change the early code, but the early code is on a LPAR by LPAR basis. Right?
Okay.
So I'm going to change the early code on one machine, you know, when I take that machine down and then point to that one. But I don't think that's what your fundamental question was about the, because you were asking where can you find out more about the release complexities.
Correct.
Right. Cause
the release migration complexities with a data sharing environment.
Right. What ends up happening is you can always do it the old way. Right. By the old way, I mean if you're migrating from version 7 to version 8 and you're in a data sharing environment, you can always take everything down, migrate one guy, and then bring everything up, and now you're running version 8. Right? You can always do it that way. But that's not interesting from an availability point of view. What's interesting from an availability point of view is taking down one member at a time and gradually getting version 8 around the environment. Now, is there a document that lists those complexities other than reading in the version 8 install guide and the version 8 data sharing manual? I don't recall off the top of my head seeing that.
Okay.
I think the install guide is going to have your best information there.
Okay.
The version 8 install guide. I don't recall seeing it elsewhere in a red book.
Yeah, but it doesn't, in the installation guide, it doesn't have any reference to taking the implementation of a new version in a data sharing environment, doing it member by member.
I'm sorry, in the install guide, it doesn't talk about...
It isn't specific to the data sharing environment where you're actually... doing the application of either maintenance or the implementation of a new version with a strategy of doing one member at a time.
For that sort of discussion, you want the data sharing planning and administration manual. It'll point back to items in the install guide that are strictly about the version 8 migration.
Okay.
But yeah, most of that. And to be honest with you, the planning administration manual for data sharing is pretty good. It's made... major strides since its first introduction, version 4.
Okay.
So hopefully
it's been since version 6 since I've taken a look at it.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
We have a follow-up question from Harry Shagmudathasan.
Mark, relating back to the question from Australia, I must admit I sort of think of it as being dangerous not to distribute your update transactions across your members, because if they're all going to one member and it fails, you're not going to be able to access your data because there will be a retained PLOC, you know, exclusive, and until you bring back that member, you're out of luck.
That's an interesting comment. I did not hear the questioner from Australia say that they were specifically about update. I thought they were keeping all of their distributed data on one member.
Right, but I'm making the comment that as part of your distributed, there could be update transactions.
That's true.
And if you have update transactions, it is, at least in my opinion, unwise to restrict them to a single member if you're interested in availability because of the retained PLOC problem.
Okay, well, now this could be a very interesting discussion. We probably don't have time for it. The question would then come in is there other workload locally that's causing those objects to be shared anyway, or is the distributed access the only thing that would cause it to be shared? And there's a whole long discussion. I think the fundamental point is if all of our update activity is on one guy and we lose that guy, then nobody can do anything until we get those update locks, you know, those retained locks released. And fundamentally, that's a legitimate point. However, the contrary point that I would make is my experience with the world in general and data sharing in particular is even if it's only one lock that's being held, Murphy's Law says it's the one that everyone wants.
But you have a fair point. If you have local access or, you know, Kix or IMS, you may have the group upload pool dependency and the IX locks already, and then it's a non-issue. But it's just something to be aware of.
Yes.
An extra comment is you know, someone said they had technical problems accessing the presentation. My guess would be it's because the presentation is an FTP site, And a number of sites have firewalls that don't let you access an FTP site. So that
might
be...
In other words, it may be a locally imposed restriction.
Yes, because I've run into that at some sites that you can't get to the IBM FTP sites. They get blocked, but you go to a different site and you can get access. Going back to Judy's answer, thank you very much for the extra sort of details. I must admit I'm unhappy that people do the bad thing.
Right.
Because I must admit, I think, you know, these days if you're doing data sharing, it's because you want to have high availability, and this sort of like sabotages having, you know, high availability, because it's those rare occurrences that you're trying to protect yourself from. But it's better to know that people do these things, even if I don't like it. So to my real question, which again goes back to this whole coupling facility configuration sort of thing,
right?
You know, back, 31.
Right.
Back in, you know, the original days of, you know, 96 and so on, the reoccurring statement was, don't share engines for your coupling facilities, right? So in other words, do not have, you know, two different, you know, sets of coupling facility structures, two different coupling facility LPARs sharing the same engines.
Right.
Because this will make your performance terrible.
Right.
Right? And this was the reoccurring strong sort of statement.
I remember that.
And then there came along a thing called dynamic coupling facility dispatching.
Right.
And the stuff that I've read sort of makes it appear as if you could, if you wanted to, have your production CF sharing the same box with your test CF and have your test CF use, you know, dynamic dispatching on and your prod having it off, as long as you're happy with your test CF providing lousy response time. Your production CF, assuming the weightings are set up properly, will give proper response time to production. Is that a correct interpretation?
I'm going to have to think about this for a second because I haven't thought about dynamic CF dispatching in a long time, quite frankly.
Oh, so let me rephrase this. Have you seen it?
I understand the question perfectly. What I'm trying to decide is, has that, you know, arena changed recently? Because I really...
Have you seen anyone do it recently?
I haven't been aware. Typically, when I go and look at a customer environment, they typically are not asking me to tune their non-production environments. They're typically worried about what's happening in production. And when we go look at production, they typically have, actually, most of the ones I see now have more than one CP for their coupling facilities. And I've not seen one recently where there was sharing going on that I knew of.
And so in those earlier ones where you saw sharing, did you say, you shouldn't do that, don't do that?
Oh, absolutely. You definitely don't – you want to have – my view, you definitely want to have one dedicated engine for your CFs. These days, with the size that your CFs are going to be, the amount of workload in the environments, I still like two. I've always liked two engines per CF. And – if you're going to have two and share one, well, you know, I can tolerate that, but I would have dynamic CF dispatching turned off and let test steal what he can when he can, and when he can't, too bad. The reason I like two is because a lot of people, once they start going, start driving their CF at 35 or 40% busy. And when one engine gets 35 or 40% busy, you're going to start seeing pretty elongated response, you know, service times. If you have two engines and the box is running 40% busy, that really means they're both busy only 16% of the time on average, and so you're going to get much better overall from the host side who's making the synchronous request. He's going to be much happier. But I haven't. The other thing, if you start playing around too much with the the number of engines available, you can get to the place where you get sync to async conversion. You familiar with that?
Yes. In fact, at least it used to be the case that that's happened if you use dynamic dispatching. But that was number of years ago that I saw that, so I don't know if that's still the case.
The environment you were describing, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the test side started getting a lot of sync to async conversion. And what we want to do is, to the extent possible, avoid that happening on the production side for response time concerns.
Yes.
But, yeah, I would clearly prefer at least one dedicated engine for production.
Right.
And then if we want to share the second one and give test a little bit,
But in your own experience, in terms of what you've seen recently, you've seen people for production using dedicated engines.
Yes. All the reports I've seen, I would say in the last 2 years, the production engines, do not show up on the report as being shared.
Okay,
they
good.
Are, two, three, four engines dedicated to production.
Good. Thank you.
At the large shops, yes.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Our final question will come from Tim Lingen with Archer Daniels Midland.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you do DB2 data sharing on one processor with multiple LPARs that does have an ICF included? If you wanted just to get started into data sharing in the test DB2 environment.
Okay. So I think what you're trying to say is, while I'm going through my learning curve, I'm going to put a non-production environment with two DB2s on one LPAR, and then ICF will have all of my structures in it. And will that work?
I mean, the DB2, would be, you'd have a test DB2 in one LPAR and another test DB2 in another LPAR doing data sharing on the same processor.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't pick the two LPARs up. Okay. So
multiple LPARs.
Test DB2-1, LPAR-1, test DB2-2, and LPAR-2, ICF in LPAR-3 with all the structures in that ICF.
Right. The processor does have ICF capability. We just have not used it, and we wanted to kind of see if we could get into the DB2 sharing environment to learn a little bit about it.
Okay. Well, the simple answer is yes, you can do that. The more complex answer is yes, you can do that, and you can learn a few things. Some of the things that I like to learn when I'm doing this with customers is what happens when I get rid of X or Y or Z. And X or Y or Z would be CF links, CF LPARs, and operating system LPARs. And in your particular environment, it would be restricted enough that some of those what-ifs you wouldn't be able to play with, right? You wouldn't be able to watch a failover from one, ICF to another if you only had one, for example, right? But if all you're trying to say is, I want to set this up, and then I want to see what locking looks like, and I want to see what the new messages are that are coming back to my applications, and I want to do that kind of stuff, sure, you can do that.
And really no one in a production environment, you really want two processors with ICF, either a CF external or ICF. I mean, to be able to truly do DB2 data sharing, you really need two processors.
Well, ideally, again, depending on what you're looking at, right? Ideally, most people who go into data sharing want it all. They want capacity, they want scalability, they want workload balancing, and they want availability, right? So if they want it all, then you do have to separate the pieces to avoid single points of failure.
Right.
If you're most concerned about virtual storage and you're getting another DB2 because you're running out of threads in the virtual storage window you have and you're going to do data sharing because now you can support more threads, and you're doing it for that reason and you don't care if it goes down, well, yeah, then you don't have to have that many, discrete parts.
What we're trying to accomplish is whenever we have to IPL a given LPAR on Saturday evening, we're just trying to figure out a way, could we allow our distributed access to DB2 while we are really IPLing our production LPAR, and so that we could use another LPAR, like our development LPAR, to be able to have production DB2 up on it, just so for distributed access while the first IPL is being done.
Okay, so what you're thinking of doing is having a two-member configuration with one member essentially dormant most of the time.
Most of the time, yeah.
And then you would wake him up and start sending work over there and then be able to IPL the first side. And, yes, that is doable. Again, Once you define a data sharing environment, I did not say this early on in the presentation, so I'm glad you brought this up. As soon as you define the first member as data sharing, the lock and the SCA are now required structures, and if they're ever not there, DB2 doesn't come up. So you would then, as soon as you do this, you now have two production DB2s, different LPARs. As soon as you decide you're ready to start doing that, when you first make the change to the first DB2 to become data sharing aware, it's going to then, from that point on, require the lock and the SCA. Right. The group buffer pools are only required if you're actively sharing between two DB2s, but the lock and the SCA have to be there, period. And that, so that you're going to have to figure that into your plans there, because that means on your normal non-Saturday night processing that production DB2 is going to be talking to the lock and the SCA. Now, because you're not sharing heavily, not much will be going on there, but it'll be required.
And do you need, like, if our processor has ICF, do you is that ICF, which is internal, is that just then generally one processor?
Depending on the model of machine you have, you can define one or more processors to that ICF.
Okay.
But those are details that are hard answered by hardware folks.
Sure.
As opposed to myself. Again, if you have production and an ICF on the same box together, you will have very few locks in there and no group buffer pools. You would still have the situation that if the whole box did melt, it might be more complicated than it is today.
Right.
But in that particular case, probably not much more so.
Okay, very good.
And there are no further questions at this time. I'll turn the conference over to Ms. McCollum for any additional closing remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedules to attend Why DB2 for ZOS Data Sharing Should Be in Your Life. A special thanks goes out to Mark for being our speaker today and our audience who had wonderful questions. If you should have any additional questions, please do not hesitate to contact me, and I will be glad to put you in touch with Mark or a DB2 sales or technical sales specialist. Also, please mark your calendars for our next customer teleconference on July 25th. Data sharing, health checks, what have we learned? Goodbye, everybody, and have a great day.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.